Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. One major U.S. company plans to drive car technology into the future. Jonathan Evans will tell you which one it is and what their new idea will mean for car drivers later in the program. But first, we hear about new technological developments in the health field. Scientists in London are working to develop a wheelchair that can be directed by its user's eye movements. The idea is that the wheelchair user could simply look in the direction in which they wanted to travel. The new technology could be used to provide better mobility to people who cannot walk and people without arms. Most people who suffer from multiple sclerosis, a disease that weakens the muscles, or spinal cord injuries, can still move their eyes. This is because the eyes are connected directly to the brain. Some technologies already let severely disabled people direct the movement of a wheelchair. They move by looking at arrows on a computer. But there are problems with that system. There is a delay between the movement of the eyes and the wheelchair.
Current tracking software often uses screen-based systems where you have a screen open and you look at locations on the screen. Problem with that is that it's very simplistic and also it diverts the user's attention from the outside world. And therefore there's more risk of not noticing obstacles or other things in the way.
Aldo Faisal is a doctor at Imperial College London. He and a team of doctors have developed software that permits users to move a wheelchair just by looking in the direction they want to take.
Our eyes are not only a window into our soul, they're also a window now to our intentions. So if we want to go somewhere, for example, if I want to go there or there, I will look there, and I will look there in a specific manner. And we can build a computer system that can decode our eye movements. And so we observe eye movements with an eye tracker, and we then try to make sense of them. And a computer interprets these commands and then drives the wheelchair accordingly.
Two cameras look at a patient's eyes and observe a patient's movements. The system then determines whether a patient is just looking around or wants to move in a certain direction. The cameras use special computer language to process instructions for movement within 10 milliseconds. The camera-based system costs only about $85. It is not very costly because computer programs do most of the work. No extra costly equipment is needed. The London team hopes to make the system available to the public within 3 years. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Cars that drive by themselves? No, it's not an idea from science fiction. One U.S. company is creating them in real life. Jonathan Evans has the story from VOA's George Pudich.
The U.S. technology company Google made a step forward in its push to develop self-driving cars. Earlier this year, the company released an early version, or a prototype, of a vehicle without any user controls. Google says someday its vehicles will be better drivers than many human drivers. Google's self-driving cars are not a rare sight in western U.S. states like California and Nevada. Lawmakers in those states are more likely to support the idea of vehicles with little human control. Until recently, Google only modified or changed mass-produced cars with normal steering wheels and pedals, the devices that guide and control the speed of the car. A person in the driver's seat could take the controls at any time. However, Google's latest self-driving car is a completely new idea. Passengers cannot control the direction or speed of the car. They also cannot slow the car down. Humans can only sit and watch as they travel along the road. The destination, where the car is going, is in the onboard computer. The car's progress can be watched on an electronic display. The top speed is limited to 40 kilometers per hour. Chris Urmson is Google's director for self-driving cars. He says that the company is excited about the possibilities of these new vehicles. Mr. Urmson says Google wants to develop the technology so that people would be able to call one of the cars and have it take them where they want to go. The car would then go to the next caller. Zoran Filippi is a professor of automotive engineering at Clemson University. He spoke to VOA on Skype. He says that by the year 2020, self-driving vehicles will be common. He says that people will be able to enjoy other activities while in the car and be very safe in traffic. Mr. Filippi adds that passengers will be able to take control of the vehicle as they reach the end of their trip. Google plans to build about 100 self-driving cars. Some of the vehicles will have manual controls. Google will test the cars on roads in California. If the tests are successful, cars without drivers may be a big part of the future of our experience of driving. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Mario Ritter. That is our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for an As It Is program on the disputed subject of hunting endangered animals for sport. And listen every day at this time for our program where we tell you about your world as it is. You can find all our programs online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and listen at the top of the hour for the latest news. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. Nouri al-Maliki said Thursday that he would leave his position as Prime Minister of Iraq. His decision opened the way for Haider Jawad al-Abadi to take Mr. Maliki's place. Former colleagues described Mr. Abadi as a good speaker and a direct person who is open to the ideas of others. He will need strong qualities. Among the issues facing the new prime minister are extremist militancy, religious division, and political disputes. The man now responsible for leading Iraq out of crisis was born in Baghdad, but he has lived much of his life outside the country. For example, he worked in Britain as an advisor in the engineering industry until the United States invaded Iraq in 2003. His family suffered under the rule of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Saddam's government arrested two of Mr. Abadi's brothers in 1980 for their association with the Dawa Party and executed them 2 years later. In 1981, the government arrested a third brother for the same reason. That brother survived, but he spent 10 years in prison. Mr. Abadi also was involved in the Dawa Party while in London. He served as an active party leader in exile. He returned home to enter politics after Saddam was ousted from leadership. As communications minister, Mr. Abadi rebuilt telephone systems that had been destroyed by war. He also brought the first mobile and internet communications services into the country. In 2005, he was elected to Parliament, then re-elected in March 2010. Last year, he led the Finance Committee. The committee's responsibility is to rebuild the Iraqi budget. More recently, Haider Jawad al-Abadi served as Deputy Speaker of Parliament. The country held parliamentary elections in April. Mr. Maliki's coalition unexpectedly won a majority of the seats. His coalition is called State of Law. On July 24, the new parliament chose Fuad Masum, a Kurd, as Iraq's new president. The constitution gives the president 2 weeks to choose a prime minister. That top official must come from Parliament's largest group. So Nouri al-Maliki felt sure that he would serve a third term. But he has lost political support since his last appointment. Many blame him for the religious divisions in Iraq. He also is accused of widespread corruption. And critics say he has permitted the growth in power of Islamic militants who have seized much of the country's north and west. Mr. Masum twice extended the deadline, the time by which a prime minister must be named. Mr. Maliki broadcast a threat to take legal action against Mr. Masum. On August 11, Mr. Masum named Mr. Abadi to the top office. In recent days, Mr. Abadi has promised to fight corruption and protect all Iraqis. He called on citizens to forget their differences and unite toward common goals for the future. From VOA Learning English, that's In the News.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Our story this week is Quiche. It was written by Jack London. Here is Shep O'Neill to tell you the story.
Quiche lived at the edge of the polar sea. He had seen 13 suns in the Eskimo way of keeping time. Among the Eskimos, the sun each winter leaves the land in darkness. And the next year, a new sun returns, so it might be warm again. The father of Quiche had been a brave man, but he had died hunting for food. Quiche was his only son. Quiche lived alone with his mother, Ikiga. One night, the village council met in the big igloo of Kloshkwan, the chief. Quiche was there with the others. He listened, then waited for silence. He said, "It is true that you give us some meat, but it is often old and tough meat and has many bones." The hunters were surprised. This was a child speaking against them. A child talking like a grown man. Quiche said, "My father, Bok, was a great hunter. It is said that Bok brought home more meat than any of the two best hunters, and that he divided the meat so that all got an equal share." "Nah, nah," the hunters cried. "Put the child out. Send him to bed. He should not talk to graybeards this way." Quiche waited until the noise stopped. "You have a wife, Ugluk," he said, "and you speak for her. My mother has no one but me, so I speak. As I say, Bok hunted greatly, but is now dead. It is only fair, then, that my mother, who was his wife, and I, his son, should have meat when the tribe has meat. I, Quiche, son of Bok, have spoken." Again there was a great noise in the igloo. The council ordered Quiche to bed. It even talked of giving him no food. Quiche jumped to his feet. "Hear me," he cried. "Never shall I speak in the council igloo again. I shall go hunt meat like my father, Bok." There was much laughter when Quiche spoke of hunting. The laughter followed Quiche as he left the council meeting. The next day, Quiche started out for the shore, where the land meets the ice. Those who watched saw that he carried his bow and many arrows. Across his shoulder was his father's big hunting spear. Again, there was laughter. One day passed, then a second. On the third day, a great wind blew. There was no sign of Quiche. His mother, Ikiga, put burned seal oil on her face to show her sorrow. The women shouted at their men for letting the little boy go. The men made no answer, but got ready to search for the body of Quiche. Early next morning, Quiche walked into the village. Across his shoulders was fresh meat. "Go, you men, with dogs and sleds, follow my footsteps. Travel for a day," he said. "There is much meat on the ice, a she-bear and her two cubs. His mother was very happy. Quiche, trying to be a man, said to her, "Come, Ikiga, let us eat, and after that I shall sleep, for I am tired." There was much talk after Quiche went to his igloo. The killing of a bear was dangerous, but it was three times more dangerous to kill a mother bear with cubs. The men did not believe Quiche had done so, but the women pointed to the fresh meat. At last, the men agreed to go for the meat that was left, but they were not very happy. One said that even if Quiche had killed the bear, he probably had not cut the meat into pieces. But when the men arrived, they found that Quiche had not only killed the bear, but had also cut it into pieces, just like a grown hunter. So began the mystery of Quiche. On his next trip, he killed a young bear. And on the following trip, a large male bear and its mate. Then there was talk of magic and witchcraft in the village. "He hunts with evil spirits," said one. "Maybe his father's spirit hunts with him," said another. Quiche continued to bring meat to the village. Some people thought he was a great hunter. There was talk of making him chief after old Kloshkwan. They waited, hoping he would come to council meetings, but he never came. "I would like to build an igloo," Quiche said one day, "but I have no time. My job is hunting, so it would be just if the men and women of the village who eat my meat build my igloo." And the igloo was built. It was even bigger than the igloo of the chief, Kloshkwan. One day, Ugluk talked to Quiche. "It is said that you hunt with evil spirits, and they help you kill the bear." "Is not the meat good?" Quiche answered. "Has anyone in the village yet become sick after eating it? How do you know evil spirits are with me? Or do you say it because I am a good hunter?" Ugluk had no answer. The council sat up late talking about Quiche and the meat. They decided to spy on him. On Quiche's next trip, two young hunters, Bim and Bon, followed him. After 5 days, they returned. The council met to hear their story. "Brothers," Bim said, "we followed Quiche, and he did not see us. The first day he came to a great bear. Quiche shouted at the bear loudly. The bear saw him and became angry. It rose high on its legs and growled, but Quiche walked up to it." "We saw it," Bon, the other hunter, said. "The bear began to run toward Quiche. Quiche ran away, but as he ran, he dropped a little round ball on the ice. The bear stopped and smelled the ball, then ate it. Quiche continued to run, dropping more balls on the ice. The bear followed and ate the balls." The council members listened to every word. Bim continued the story. "The bear suddenly stood up straight and began to shout in pain." "Evil spirits," said Ugluk. "I do not know," said Bon. "I can tell only what my eyes saw." The bear grew weak. Then it sat down and pulled at its own fur with its sharp claws. Quiche watched the bear that whole day. For 3 more days, Kish continued to watch the bear. It was getting weaker and weaker. Kish moved carefully up to the bear and pushed his father's spear into it. "And then?" asked Plushquan. "And then we left." That afternoon, the council talked and talked. When Kish arrived in the village, the council sent a messenger to ask him to come to the meeting. But Kish said he was tired and hungry. He said his igloo was big and could hold many people if the council wanted a meeting. Plushquan led the council to the igloo of Kish. Kish was eating, but he welcomed them. Plushquan told Kish that 2 hunters had seen him kill a bear. And then, in a serious voice to Kish, he said, "We want to know how you did it. Did you use magic and witchcraft?" Kish looked up and smiled. "No, Plushquan, I am a boy. I know nothing of magic or witchcraft. But I have found an easy way to kill the ice bear. It is headcraft, not witchcraft." "And will you tell us, O Kish?" Plushquan asked in a shaking voice. "I will tell you. It is very simple. Watch." Kish picked up a thin piece of whalebone. The ends were pointed and sharp as a knife. Kish bent the bone into a circle. Suddenly, he let the bone go, and it became straight with a sharp snap. He picked up a piece of seal meat. "So," he said, "first make a circle with a sharp, thin piece of whalebone. Put the circle of bone inside some seal meat. Put it in the snow to freeze. The bear eats the ball of meat with the circle of bone inside. When the meat gets inside the bear, the meat gets warm, and the bone goes snap. The sharp points make the bear sick. It is easy to kill then. It is simple." Ugluk said, "Oh." Plushquan said, "Ah." Each said something in his own way, and all understood. That is the story of Kish, who lived long ago on the edge of the polar sea. Because he used headcraft instead of witchcraft, he rose from the poorest igloo to be the chief in the village. And for all the years that followed, his people were happy. No one cried at night with pains of hunger.
You have heard the story, Kish. It was written by Jack London. Your storyteller was Shep O'Neill. This is Shirley Griffith.